It Was Almost Real, the Pro Wrestling History Podcast, Episode 52. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of It Was Almost Real, the Pro Wrestling History Podcast. And this is the podcast dedicated to professional wrestling history from 1870 to 1920, when it was almost real. Although sometimes we range up into the 1930s. And in this episode, once again, I will be doing a solo episode. If you listened to the last episode, it was our intention to get together a ship of fools on April Fool's Day and record this week's episode. Well, owing to some technical difficulties, we were not able to record that episode. And Dan, good news, Dan should be going home this week, so I think the next episode will be recorded in the Million Dollar Studio. At least that's our hope. So I am recording this on Sunday, April 7th, which is the morning after the first night of WrestleMania, and I will be doing a review as part of the review on this podcast. My hope has been that on the next episode that we will do a review of WrestleMania with Trey and Caleb. As regular listeners know, they were not wrestling fans growing up. I didn't really watch it because I didn't like the violence against women that went on in the Attitude Era. So they were never really fans of pro wrestling. They were MMA fans. They grew up as martial artists. Wrestling really wasn't their thing. So they're kind of discovering this now as adults, as participants in the podcast. Some of it they like, some of it they don't understand. And unfortunately, I can't recreate how it was back in the 1980s when I first started, or late 79, when I first started watching. So they'll never quite understand what it was like in the 80s because everything is at your fingertips today. Back then, if you missed it, you missed it. You weren't going to see it again. I would like them to watch some of the matches this year's WrestleMania and give us their thoughts and opinions on those matches, because I think it's sometimes interesting to get their perspective as people who are not wrestling fans. You know, or would you even be attracted to this today? Because the audience for professional wrestling is much smaller today, even though it doesn't quite have the stigma that it used to have of being a wrestling fan. You were sort of like a combination of an alien and some kind of weirdo if you like professional wrestling back in the 80s and 90s. So that is my plan for the next episode, which will come out on April 22nd. I'm not going to have them watch the whole 8-hour show. I didn't really want to watch the whole 8-hour show, but I did watch the first night in its totality to give it a fair airing, and I was pretty impressed. Before I get into the main historical topic this week, which is the promotional war between Tex Rickard and Jack Curley, I did want to say that I have finished the book on Chief Desmond, the St. Louis Chief of Detectives, from 1890 to 1907. And Chief Desmond, his force of detectives, were responsible for catching a couple of the Wild Bunch members, Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid's gang, out west. They caught a couple of the members here in St. Louis, and both of them did time in the Missouri Penitentiary. The relationships he developed with some of the more hardened criminals over the years also led to the discovery of H.H. Holmes, the first serial killer in America. He is the one that had the purported murder house in Chicago during the 1893 World's Fair. And he was involved in train robbery investigations and protected St. Louis, the St. Louis World's Fair during the 1904 World's Fair. Chief Desmond, his detectives, and a supplemental force of some private security, but mostly police officers from around the country, protected the World's Fair from April of 1904 to November of 1904. And I always wanted to write a book about Chief Desmond because I consider him the Sherlock Holmes of St. Louis and really a forgotten pillar of the St. Louis community. That book is completed. It's available on Amazon in every format except audiobook. I will get that done in the next few weeks, but it is available on Kindle, paperback, hardback. And if you like to go shopping for your books at bookstores, it should be available there in the next several months, as I've also published it through Ingram Spark. Paperback version. I don't publish ebooks through Ingram Spark. So that's it for the update this week, and we'll hopefully get more into WrestleMania in the next episode. But I wanted to go back in time to the late teens and early 1920s, because in the book I'm writing right now on John the Nebraska Tiger Man Pesek, Pesek is famous for settling a few promotional wars in the 1920s that sprung up between promoters who were having rivalries. So in the first promotional war that he settled, Pesek wrestled Marin Plastina in New York. And that promotional war was actually not between two wrestling promoters. I guess it was after a fashion. But Tex Rickard, who was primarily a boxing promoter, and Jack Curley, who was primarily a wrestling promoter, both of them based out of New York City, had been partners in promoting boxing and had had a falling out at some point. And one of the things I want to do with this book and research project is really get to the crux of what caused the animosity between Jack Curley and Tex Rickard. And I've got two possibilities, and they both may be true, because a lot of times in history, seldom is it one thing that is the cause for something. It's usually a few causes, some more important than others. But things don't tend to happen in a vacuum, and there's generally doesn't tend to be one cause for why something happened. It's particularly important to think about that when you're trying to analyze why things are done in the political arena, because there are so many different factors and so many different concerns and interests pushing on each other that it's almost never one reason why a policy went one way. There's normally a myriad of reasons. It's no different in personal conflicts like a promotional rivalry or a sports rivalry. There are normally a number of causes, but one or two may be more important than the others. And based on that belief, the two parallel tracks I'm looking at are, one, it could have just simply been that they were partners in the Jess Willard, Jack Dempsey promotion. That fight was profitable, but it was not profitable to the degree that a lot of the other fights that Tex Rickard promoted were financially successful. What kind of surprises me is already in February of 1921, Rickard is backing Marin Plastina in his challenge of Curley and his four top wrestlers, Joe Stecker, Earl Caddick, Ed Strangler Lewis, and Vladek Zabisco. Yet, I was reading that Curley was still involved in Rickard's promotion of the Dempsey Georges Carpentier fight in, I think it was April of 1921. It's the first $1 million gate. So before Plastina and Pesek wrestle in November 1921 to settle this promotional war, it looks like Curley was still involved in the boxing promotion business with Rickard, at least going into that Carpentier fight. But what may have hurt their relationship going into the Carpentier Dempsey fight could have been an earlier boxing venture of Jack Curley. Jack Curley was primarily a wrestling promoter, but he dabbled in boxing promotion as early as the mid-19-teens. And in 1915, the world heavyweight boxing champion was the great Jack Johnson. But because he was an African-American boxer, he was often plotted against, not only by other boxing promoters, managers, organized crime, the boxing associations. The federal government also did not like having an African-American champion who was so bold and blatant about living life on his own terms. So they used the Mann Act to charge him with having consensual relations with white women but crossing state lines to go to hotels and that with them. Total misuse of the statute. But they used that to charge him with a federal felony, so Johnson had to flee the United States to avoid being prosecuted and put in prison for a violation of the Mann Act, which was to stop interstate prostitution, not to catch the heavyweight champion with one of his girlfriends. While Johnson is in exile in Europe, he finds out that his mother is sick, and he wants to come back and see his mother, but to do that, he's got to do something about the charges that are hanging over his head. And there's lots of conjecture about whether this really happened or not, because this fight happens in 1915. Johnson finally surrendered himself to authorities in 1920, and he does spend a year in prison for violating the Mann Act. So if the federal government was intending to make a deal with him, they backed out of that deal. But according to Jack Johnson, and there are lots of boxing historians who do not agree with this version, and I'll give you why they don't after we talk about it. But this is Jack Johnson's version of what happened, and this was printed in the newspapers in the spring of 1921, and this could be what ruined the relationship between Rickard and Curley. So Johnson said that he approached some boxing promoters about fighting Jess Willard, not in the United States, because if he set foot in the United States, he's going to be arrested, but in Havana, Cuba. And he agrees to fight Willard. And according to Johnson, Jack Curley was one of the organizers of this fight. And he works out with Curley that he will lose the bout to Willard, who was the great white hope at the time, the top boxer that people thought might actually be able to beat Jack Johnson. And he would drop the title, and in return for dropping the title, the U.S. government would drop the Mann Act charges, and he could come back to the United States and see his mother. According to what Johnson also says in the newspaper, which would be in character with Jack Curley, because Curley was known to pull gambling schemes when it came to his wrestling bouts, Curley, knowing that Johnson was going to drop the bout to Willard to be able to come back to the United States, bet a large sum of money on Willard and made over $30,000. Now, that could be apocryphal because they always seem to grab $30,000. In one of the same articles where they're talking about Johnson or Curley getting $30,000 from a gambling scheme on the Johnson-Willard bout. And I would think that that's probably a low number. If he was involved in a gambling scheme, he probably would have been able to take in a lot more than that for such a huge fight, which Johnson would have been favored to win. He was reported to have won over $30,000 on the Gotch-Hackenschmidt bout of 1911, where he knew Hackenschmidt should not have been in the ring because he was too debilitated with a knee injury. Well, the 30,000 number in that article was true, but that didn't come from a gambling scheme. We can't verify whether Curley also took a big pot of money on a gambling scheme, because he did call off the bets for that bout so that Hackenschmidt would go on with it in 1911, about 2 or 3 days before the match actually happened on Labor Day 1911. However, that doesn't mean there was not gambling on that, and that doesn't mean that Curley did not receive gambling winnings on that bout either. But we don't know how many that would have been. There's something in the Fall Guys that was said it was in the neighborhood of 30,000. But again, you have to be able to confirm that information. You just can't take it out of the Fall Guys at face value and say, this is what happened. But he did get $30,000 from the match with Hackenschmidt and Gotch, because for Hackenschmidt to come back to the United States and wrestle Gotch, his percentage of the purse and the film rights and everything was supposed to be $43,000. And Curly stole $30,000 of that and only gave Hackenschmidt $13,000. And Hackenschmidt was so embarrassed after getting eaten up by Gotch and just wanted to go back to Europe. He stayed in the United States for like 3 or 4 days, thought about suing Curly and said, forget it, and took his $13,000 and went back to England. So I'm not going to say that Curly did or did not make a killing on the gambling on the Johnson-Willard fight, but it would be in caricature for Jack Curly to do something like that. That would be a way he would have operated business-wise. A lot of boxing historians have taken issue with Johnson's version of events. Johnson showed up for that fight with Willard in horrible condition. He couldn't find good sparring partners in Europe. He didn't run into the racism that he did in the United States, but he still didn't have an easy time of it in Europe. And he was wanting to come back home. So he was out of shape. He hadn't really trained well for it. And he decides that, you know, he's going to come into this bout in the shape he's in. Willard was in shape. But even being in shape, Johnson won the first 19 rounds. So it was a 45-round fight. They went, and it was Havana, Cuba, and it was hot. And after about the 19th round, Johnson starts to visibly weaken. And in the 26th round, Willard, who was a big puncher, big guy, lands a combination that knocks Johnson out. And if you could see me right now, I'm doing the air quotes, because he could have straight knocked him out. Or there's one picture that Ring Magazine published, and Ring Magazine always said, yeah, we think it was a straight win, but it's possible that it was a dive, because Johnson is laying back on the mat and he's got his right hand across his eyes as he's laying on the mat, shielding his eyes from the bright sun. So even at that 1915, there was some conjecture, well, maybe he took a dive, but we think this was legitimate. And Jess Willard, when people came up to him and said that, hey, Johnson said he took a dive, he said, well, man, I wish he would have done it sooner. It was hot out there, you know. And that was one of the points against it being a dive, is if he was going to take a dive, he knew he was going to lose. Why box 26 rounds first? I guess you want to make it look good and not be charged by the boxing commission, but still, you could have probably went out there, did maybe 15 rounds and got out of there. And he was clearly winning the first part of that fight before he started to weaken, which could have just been from his lack of training. We'll never really know whether he took the dive or not, but he always claimed that he did from the 1920s on. So what does all of that have to do with the promotional war and the feud between Tex Rickard and Jack Curly? Well, there is a New York State Athletic Commission in New York from at least the 19-teens on. And if the New York State Athletic Commission gets word that Curly is taking part in fixed bouts, Curly will be banned from participating in any boxing. And it can also affect Rickard's ability to promote boxing, because he could be banned too, because they might think, well, you're working with Curly, you're also trying to fix fights. So that's another avenue which what could have caused the conflict between Rickard and Curly. And when the book comes out in a couple months, I'm hoping you'll be able to know which or if both were the reasons for the promotional war. So the history section's a little short this week, but I just wanted to throw that out there. I'm about a third of the way through that book, and I think that I will be able to get it out before the middle of July. And then the next book won't come out till late fall, early winter, or even late winter, because I'm going to research for 2.5 months while I'm at the busy season at my normal day job. I'm going to just focus on research for that 2.5 months. And topics for the podcast and blog posts and things like that. But I won't start on a new book probably until October 1st. So WrestleMania 40 was last night, day one. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to get you the results of day two before this podcast comes out, because the podcast is going to come out Monday morning, April 8th. There'll be a lot of people reviewing WrestleMania. So this is just my take as a fan and a historian. And I really liked the show, so I guess I should lead with that. And the reason I really liked it is it's more the way professional wrestling used to be than it is the modern stuff. The modern stuff is here to stay, and we'll never get completely away from it, which we'll talk about here in a few minutes. But Triple H came out to open the show, and Paul Levesque, who's the creative content officer, and really he's the one running the show from a creative and probably even a talent relations standpoint. And they're in very good hands. And if there were more wrestling fans nowadays, he could probably be elected president, because he got one of the biggest ovations of the night because people like him, because they brought back the kind of wrestling more people like. And it showed as 72,000 people showed up for the first night of WrestleMania. So they haven't made too many missteps with Triple H, and I don't think they're going to make a ton with him in charge. So the night started off with Rhea Ripley wrestling Becky Lynch. And I didn't give the disclaimer at the very beginning. There will be spoilers in this. So if you have not watched day one and you want to watch day one before you hear my thoughts on it, just stop the podcast now, go watch it, and then come back and listen to the end of this. But they opened the show, and I thought it was a good way to open the show because both of these wrestlers are very over, probably two of the most popular wrestlers in the company, and I expected it to be a very good match. I thought that people might have a hard time following it, but actually they announced before the match that Becky Lynch had been battling strep throat all week, and I actually think that was probably a shoot. She probably was battling strep throat because her timing was really off for the first 3 or 4 minutes, but then she got into the match and the two of them really picked it up, and it was a very good match for the Women's World Championship. It went 17 minutes. There was only one or two spots where they were on the top rope and they did some obvious cooperation. And Rhea, I think, used two riptides to win the match after 17 minutes. All in all, I thought the outfits were a little odd. And one of the things that they did all night long, this is a lesson for AEW about how to run a business. Someone should watch that show and just pick up the business aspects of it. One of the first things they did in the very first match before they brought the wrestlers out was they put up a little graphic. Everything in WWE shop is 25% off this weekend. Sell some merchandise. Help make your company more profitable. Put little things like that in there. They spent, I'm sure, tens of millions of dollars on the production values with the acts they brought in and some of the special lifts, special effects, the video packages and everything. But they made a tremendous profit on this event. Take a lesson. You can spend money, but make sure you're bringing in enough to offset it. And I do have to commend Tony Khan here. He just recently cut 10 wrestlers from the company. I know we all hate it when people lose their job, but he has too many wrestlers. And it doesn't mean they're never going to work for anybody again or anything else, but go somewhere, learn a new hold, as Jim Ross loves to say, and then come back. But he's got way too many wrestlers that he cannot use. So the opening match, great match. The second match on the card. If I never see another ladder match for the rest of my life, it will be too soon. I hate these ladder matches. It's just an opportunity for people to take riskier and riskier stunts that eventually is going to kill or cripple someone. I'm surprised that it hasn't happened yet, that somebody hasn't taken one of these goofy falls onto these ladders, which do not work. And this match here, and in the last match I saw, which was Buddy Matthews, I think, versus Andrade when he was still with AEW, and they did several spots where they landed on the person on the ladder, and the ladder was meant to break, and the ladder did not break. And you could see just the pain shudder through the people's body when they take that bump. They're unnecessary. They're way too many. This was a six-pack tag team ladder match. 12 freaking people. It was like trying to keep up with a battle royal. With all of that said, and it lasted 17 minutes and 25 seconds, which was 17 minutes and 24 seconds too long, the Undisputed title is split back up, which is a very good thing, and A-Town, Down Under, Austin Theory, and Grayson Waller won the SmackDown Championship. Hooray. These two guys are part of your future. Them, Bron Breakker. Gunther's older than these guys, but I would throw Gunther in there. This is your next crop that's right underneath the Codys and the Romans and all of that that are going to take the WWE to their next 10 or 15 years. And if you don't quit beating Theory and Waller to powder and making them look like absolute idiots, they're going to be the next Miz or Dolph Ziggler. Really talented people that were beat down so bad so many times that people can't take them seriously anymore. Same thing has happened to Shinsuke Nakamura, one of the biggest stars ever from Japan, and he could be much better, but unfortunately, Triple H only had him in NXT, then Vince mucked him up so bad it wasn't even funny, and that was mucked, M-U-K-E-D. We're not going to get a adult rating on this podcast. Vince beat him to powder and made him look terrible, so nobody can take him seriously either. You have to start giving Theory and Waller some wins. And I liked the fact that they took the SmackDown Championship in this horrible match. And then Awesome Truth, The Miz and R-Truth, won the Raw Championship. I don't believe that they're going to hold that title for very long, but it was a nice WrestleMania moment for R-Truth. I don't like his goofy character. I hated this match, but the outcome was the best thing that you could expect from this terrible car wreck of a match. And you know, I say there was two spots in there where, you know, you can't say anything about AEW where they're all standing around like quail when they're doing the exact same thing in WWE. Two guys climb up the ladder, and for no reason, the other 10 people, five on each side, are standing behind waiting for the guys to dive off and catch them. It's stupid. So, and it's stupid because you don't know where that body is going, and these guys, even if they're on the light side, they're 180, 190 pounds. And you got, you know, arms and legs can be broken and everything. I'm just, it's a disaster. So, if you couldn't tell, not a fan of the ladder matches. Match number 3 was a very pleasant surprise. And that was Rey Mysterio and Andrade, which I think got made on Friday. I think it was absolutely last minute. Wrestled Santos Escobar and Dirty Dominic Mysterio. And Dominic has got to be one of the best chicken crap heels in the history of wrestling. And this was, it was a typical Luchas match. Lots of high spots. There was a spot in there where Rey gets up on Andrade's shoulders and Andrade is sitting on the top turnbuckle facing out to the floor, and they do a diving double body press onto Escobar and Dominic Mysterio on the floor, which I have never seen before and was super cool. It may be something that's done in AAA, but I haven't seen it in the... I've probably seen 20 or 30 AAA matches on YouTube, and I've never seen that particular move before. But all in all, it was a nice little 11-minute match. And at the end, Santos Escobar tells Dom to get a chair and just waffle his dad, who's hanging over the ropes. And these two masked luchadors, again, we're going to put them in air quotes, jump the railing, and one, who looked to be about 6'8", takes the chair away from him. And the other one, that's 6'2", grabs Dom, throws him into the post, and then chucks him into the ring, and he gets pinned. And it turns out those mysterious luchadors were Lane Johnson and Jason Kelsey of the Philadelphia Eagles. Shout out to my Eagles, my favorite team in the NFL, and Jason Kelsey, the all-time great center for the Eagles. That was a cool little spot there in Philadelphia. One of my favorite parts of the night so far. So, a surprising match. I didn't have a lot of high hopes going into it, but I was really pleasantly surprised. Match number 4 was one I had really been looking forward to for a long time, and that was Jey Uso versus Jimmy Uso, because I am a big fan of main event Jey Uso. I love the storyline with him and Roman back on SmackDown 2000-2021. I was really disappointed with this match. They told a good story at the end, but it was just a lot of super kicks and open hand slaps. And for something that really should have pushed Jay into that next group of wrestlers, I didn't think that it did it. And to be honest, I think Jay was better off when he was the right-hand man, main event Jey Uso, Tribal Chief number 2. This singles run has not shown him to the best of his abilities and what he can do, but still one of my absolute favorite wrestlers. I'm just a little bit disappointed in that match. And so for the match that probably disappointed me the most, we go to the match that surprised me the most. And that was Bianca Belair, Jade Cargill, and Naomi. And they wrestled Damage Control, Dakota Kai, Asuka, and Kairi Sane. And I've always been a big Asuka fan. And Bianca is just amazing. Athleticism off the chart. And, you know, Dakota Kai, she is a unsung, really solid wrestler who I've enjoyed the stuff she's done when I've seen her wrestle. But I did not have great hopes for this match at all. Jade is very green. And Naomi's just coming back, a little ring rusty. And this was just sort of a match put together to give both teams of women something to do. And for all of that, it turned out to be surprisingly good. They got the big entrance. There's no question at all. Jade Cargill looks like a star. When you see her, you're like, that's somebody. And Bianca has that same are about her as well. And the match was fast-paced, had an interesting finish with Asuka accidentally missing Kairi Sane, her tag team partner. And a thing, you know, the match ending was to highlight the athleticism and strength of Jade Cargill. But the one thing that I didn't like about this match, and I've seen it in so many matches that's going to happen in our main event, is when you have these tag matches and somebody gets knocked to the floor and then they just disappear for like minutes. Naomi disappears in this 8-minute match, I'm going to say for about 4 minutes. And to the point where I was like, did she get hurt and Jade and Bianca are just finishing this match? Didn't look that way at the end when they were all celebrating, but I started to question whether she had a legitimate injury and couldn't get back in the ring. That's how long she was out there. And then as they do the replay for the finish, which was Jade Cargill doing a version of a slam, you see Bianca Belair outside the ring sitting there watching to see when they get to the finish so she can get back in the ring. But she's just sitting out there watching, which looks ridiculous in a what's supposed to be athletic or pro wrestling or sports entertainment or whatever we're calling it this week. This, they need to start pulling that back. I don't know. Well, I know when it became a thing. It became a thing under Vince within the last 5 or 8 years. They need to start pulling that back. If it happened once in a while, it wouldn't be so noticeable. But it's happening several times a show where people just disappear. And then you might get a camera angle that you see, oh, they're just sitting out there watching and waiting for the next thing that they're supposed to do. So the sixth match, to me, was the match of the night. And that was Sami Zayn versus Gunther. And I will admit, going into this match, I thought that there wasn't a chance on earth that Sami Zayn had any chance of beating Gunther. I thought this was going to be close to a squash for Gunther and to get him ready to take on a world champion. But when I saw the build-up to it and how Sami was interacting with his wife and child and Kevin Owens, and they were really pushing this Rocky theme, are they going to let Sami Zayn win the Intercontinental Championship? Surely they're not going to take the title off Gunther. But then the announcers said Gunther had been champion for 666 days. And I said, yeah, they're probably going to take the title off him because it's time to start getting him ready for a world championship. And one thing I have to say, I have to commend the announce team of Michael Cole, Corey Graves, and Pat McAfee. All night long, their commentary enhanced all of the matches, which is what you want out of your announce team. They helped build the excitement over it. They helped focus your attention on the important things. They highlighted the important parts of the story. There was an interesting dynamic between all three of them because Michael Cole is very outspoken in how much he likes Pat McAfee. And he announced that Corey Graves is the heir apparent to fill the Michael Cole role one day. But it was interesting, in several of the matches, McAfee was agreeing with Graves, and they were both sort of disagreeing and arguing with Michael Cole. So it was a really interesting dynamic, but they never got to the point where they were trying to make themselves the show. Their announcing was enhancing the storylines and helping to tell the story. And it was really refreshing. And it probably helped that Vince wasn't screaming in their ear while it was all going on. So we haven't talked about that much, but this show really benefited from the absence of Mr. McMahon. The match itself is what you would expect. Very hard-hitting. They both really laid those chops in. Really, both of them had really red chests a couple minutes into the match. Gunther played up the horrible heel that keeps poking Sammy's wife, telling her, throw in the towel, why do you just let him suffer like this? And just really getting the crowd ticked off at him and in Sammy's corner. And Sammy has really been cooled off since the feud with Roman Reigns and the Bloodline. But I think this kind of heated him back up. So it'll be interesting to see where Sammy goes as the Intercontinental Champion. He may not hold it very long. He's the kind of guy that can get over with the crowd without having a title. But I did think that it was the best match of the night. It told a great story. Everything that Sammy and Gunther did made a lot of sense, and it was by far my favorite match. I was thinking about just doing night two matches for Trey and Caleb to watch, but I'd really like them to watch this match and give me their thoughts on it because I liked it so much. And these are just my opinions based on what I like to see and what makes sense to me. I was listening to Dutch Mantel's podcast the other day where they went over the best wrestlers not to be world champion. And while I agreed with several of Dutch's picks, I disagreed with a couple of them. Well, who am I? You know, Dutch is an insider. He has more inside knowledge. But it doesn't mean that I have to just say, oh yeah, that. And he and Jim Cornette have had opposite opinions on the same people too, even though their philosophies of wrestling are much more in a line than they're out of a line. Everybody doesn't have to agree with everybody. So some people are going to like things that other people don't, and it's just their opinion. Please feel free to disagree with me on any of my opinions about these. Because I expect my opinion about the main event, the biggest tag team match since Hogan and Mr. T versus Roddy Piper and Paul Orndorff, the Bloodline of The Rock and Roman Reigns with Paul Heyman going against Cody Rhodes and Seth freaking Rollins, was probably my least favorite match of the night outside of the ladder match. The ladder match I wouldn't have even had. I just didn't like this match. Maybe if it was 20 minutes instead of 44, I would have liked it. It went too long. There were too many near falls, too many kicks out of things. And so The Rock was bigger than Roman Reigns for this match. They announced him at 280. I'm thinking he was every bit of that because he looked like a bodybuilder. He didn't look quite as freakish as some of the Mr. Olympia competitors, but he had a physique better than a lot of the ones I've seen win the USA and things like that. He was jacked to the gills. Now, on one aspect, it did help a little bit. The Rock is not as fast or as explosive, athletic, as he used to be, which, duh. He's either 52 or going to be 52. You can't expect The Rock to have that same explosiveness, athleticism. In all honesty, he probably shouldn't even be in the ring, and we'll talk about the end of the match here in just a little bit. But he took it seriously. He got in great condition. And that being so big, it kind of helped because you're not expecting somebody that huge to be as quick or as athletic as he used to be. So it kind of covered up the fact that he's a 52-year-old guy because he looks so amazing. That being said, the match was very slow developing. I mean, snail's pace. It took them 20-something minutes to get in the ring, and then they wrestled for 44 minutes. And there were spots where they were out on the floor for 5 or 10 minutes, and which they covered up by The Rock saying, if you start counting, you're fired. And, you know, I'm sorry. This whole evil authority figure was played out 15 to 20 years ago. So this whole Rock is the final boss in that is more annoying than entertaining. And it is so, so played out. This match, they didn't have as many goofy high spots, which you wouldn't expect. It took so long. And yeah, they told a story, But it was a long, drawn-out story that I'm surprised people were still awake for at the end of this thing. And, which this actually could really, to me, make the... I think it's going to make the match on Sunday night better. The Rock and Roman Reigns ended up beating Seth Rollins and Cody, and it really sets up Sunday night nicely. So the outcome, again, of a bad match made sense and enhanced the story, even though I personally didn't care for that match at all. Seth Rollins is definitely compromised with a bad knee going into the match with Drew McIntyre, and I expect Drew McIntyre to win that match and become the World Heavyweight Champion. And, or one of the versions of that. And then Roman Reigns Universal Championship, I expect Cody Rhodes to beat him for that. The only fly in the ointment there, and I can't believe they would do this because it would step all over Cody's story and really middle their number one babyface, is you still got Senior Money in the Bank who hasn't cashed that contract in yet. I can't see him cashing it in on Drew, but maybe he could. And I can't see him cashing it in on the Roman Reigns-Cody match because that would make that match a lot less memorable and mean a lot less. I don't see that happening. So I expect Cody, against all odds and bloodline interference and everything else, to complete his story and win the title at WrestleMania tonight. So those are my predictions coming out of that match. At some point in time, The Rock and Roman are going to have some friction. And Roman did accidentally spear The Rock, which I thought was going to be the end of the match and a win for Cody and Seth. But it makes much more sense from a storyline standpoint to have The Rock and Roman win that match on Saturday, because then it forces Cody to overcome even more odds to be the world champion. I mean, they are universal champion. Then again, the announce crew did a nice job last night, because they basically, after The Rock pinned Cody, they're like, well, better luck next time, Cody. You're not going to finish your story this year. So the announcers were smart enough to kind of write it off, so when Cody does overcome it, it will be even a bigger deal that he was the one to end Roman Reigns' streak. Match itself, I can't recommend. You may disagree with me. If you enjoyed it, you know, good on you. Not my cup of tea at all. And before I sign off for this week, I have not watched mixed martial arts since the last week of January. And I'm sorry to say, I'm not missing it. And I love MMA, but I'm just not in love with these fighters, and I'm not in love with the company. So I hope the company doesn't do to WWE what it has done to UFC. And the only thing it's really hurt with UFC is it uses a lot of interchangeable people that aren't big stars, that aren't really over with the MMA crowd, to put on these cards every weekend so they can get their rights fees paid to them. And most of the champions are not likable. I don't see WWE making that mistake, particularly as long as Triple H is around. Now, how could TKO completely screw up their business? They could decide they need a clean break from the McMahon era and let go of Triple H and try to put some other yahoo in there, the head of creative. Even somebody experienced like a Bruce Pritchard, you know, you're just going to shoot yourself in the foot, and you'll be worse than what the UFC came into with all of these. Because one of the things they do to keep the cost down is they'll do these Dana White looking for a fight, and they'll sign these young fighters, and then they'll cut the veterans who are making more money. Because it is a business, but it's a sports business. And I don't think that the fan is always the number one concern of that. So I will get ESPN Plus again in May to watch the Championship, League One, and League Two playoffs in England. But that's the only month of the year that I will have it from now on. Connor's not fighting. there's not a whole lot keeping my interest in the MMA world right now. So I still love it. I still watch one championship every great once in a while. In May, I'm sure I'll watch at least some of the fighters I like on those cards. But it's not tempting me enough to pay $10.99 a month or $100 a year for the ESPN subscription, which I think is way overpriced. But anytime you're dealing with the Disney company, it's going to be way overpriced. So I think that's all I have. The week two matches we'll probably talk about on the next podcast, which will come out on Monday, April 22nd. Next week is our break week, where I'll have a blog post up. And if you like the show, please leave us a rating or a comment, where you listen to your podcasts at. It helps people discover us and find the show. And until next time, take care, everybody. Bye-bye.